you are, for example, following Grand Ayatollah Khamenei or maybe Grand Ayatollah Sistani, as long as you're acting according to the fatwa of your marja, I think there'll be no problem.
Right.
You have to stick to actually the mu'minin, the believers, should stick to the fatwa of their believers, of their mujtahid, and inshallah, there will be no problem. Of course, if there is any problem with regards to the beginning or the end of the lunar month, so again, the problem can be solved, and it's not a big deal as long as you understand that every scholar, every mujtahid has his own opinion and his principles based on which he infer the legal rulings.
Could any technology be into consideration when it comes to sighting of the moon, or, for example, for the end of the previous month and the beginning of the new month?
Well, that's where the shoe pinches, in fact, because, some scholars are of the view that in the early period of Islam, okay, there was no such device, no technology, no telescope or something to be used to ascertain the beginning of every month. So that's why they still hold that there should no such instrument must be involved, and that every individual must establish the beginning of the month through their own naked eyes. Right. On the contrary, some other scholars, including His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, is of the view that if you use any device such as a telescope, binoculars, or anything like that, which could ascertain the beginning of a lunar month, there is no problem. Even if you fly, using a helicopter and go over the clouds to find the moon or to establish the moon, and then come back and make an announcement declaring the beginning or the end of the month, there is no problem. As we can see in Iran, for example, a lot of people are commissioned to go out and they take their instruments with them, and they use even helicopters to go up and see the moon without any cloud preventing visibility.
I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javed. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Just stay with us.
Ya Allah, thank you for another chance standing at my door. Ya Allah, you give me hope, deliver this gift right to my home. مرحب مرحب يا رمضان أحيي قلوبنا بالقرآن حل ليالينا بالقيام أهلا أهلا بالصيام.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to the great month of God, the month of Ramadan, with Sheikh Javed. Sheikh Javed, when it is not clear, or when we are not sure whether this is the last day of Sha'ban, which is the preceding month to the next month, the month of Ramadan, or if it is the first day of Ramadan, what should we do? Can we fast that day, that Yom Shag, basically?
That's a pretty good question, since we do understand that that a lot of people who do not have access to their mujtahid or to the offices of their mujtahid, since they are living in other countries,
exactly,
or maybe even in a far flung area, having no connection, no telephone number, or nothing, so they doubt whether it is the end of the Shaban or the beginning of the month of Ramadan. In such cases, of course, it is necessary to In fact, one cannot observe fast with the intention of observing the fast of Ramadan, because as long as you are not sure that the month of Ramadan has started, you cannot make niyyah of fasting or observing the fast of Ramadan. You can fast, but it could be the fast, a qada fast, or it could be kind of fast on behalf of someone else. Maybe you can make niyyah of fasting on behalf of someone else. So fasting is basically permissible, but not with the intention of observing the fast of Ramadan, because you're not sure that the month of Ramadan has set in. Okay. Now, if later on you come to know that it was actually the first of Ramadan, then it will count as the first day of Ramadan, and there's no objection.
So should we leave the niyyah, the intention, open to God to be read? Like, if it is the last day of Sha'ban, then it would be considered as a kind of recommended fast, right?
Yes.
If it is the first day of Ramadan, then it would be considered as a compulsory, actually, fasting, right?
Yeah, you cannot be, decisively or make a niyyah that it is the first of Ramadan. Probably there is a chance of that day being the first of Ramadan, but you cannot. And the thing is that everything has to do with your niyyah, with the back of your mind,
right,
what you are actually intending when you are fasting. So if you intend to fast only, it's just a fast, and not the fast of the month of the first day of Ramadan, then that's okay.
Just a bit. You mentioned here in your answer that, you know, Muslims live everywhere.
Yeah.
Different corners of the world, right?
Yes.
So if they don't have access to the local religious scholars, can they base their horizon, wherever they are, on the horizon of the Muslim nations, like, for example, in the Middle East, and listen to the their religious authority or marja regarding, for example, whether it is the first day of Ramadan or the last day of Sha'ban?
Again, it's a very difficult question, very challenging, because they may not have the same horizon, okay? And someone who lives in, for example, in Australia, may not have the same, he may not have the same horizon as we do here in the Middle East, or those people living in America or in the United States.
Exactly.
Europe
is very close to the
Middle
East. Yeah,
Europe is very close.
But Australia and America, Latin America, they are far away.
So that's right? Why we see that the scholars differ in their opinion.
Exactly.
When it comes to the beginning of the month. Even some religious scholars, for example, a few years ago, let's say, one of the religious scholars who's very well known across the Middle East said that, okay, for example, today is the first day of Ramadan for the people in the Middle East, but it's not the first day of the Ramadan for the people in, let's say, South Africa or maybe North America. So because they think that maybe they have their own instruments through which actually they establish the beginning of the month of Ramadan, and we do not have anything to say with regards to the instruments or maybe the principle, the procedures they follow to ascertain the beginning.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, yeah, Allah. Guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, 'cause 'cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program. Anshar Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to the month of Ramadan. Sheikh Javid, we all know that niyyah or intention is, if not the most important, but at least we could say that it is one of the most important elements of every act, especially when it comes to worshiping God, right? Not only in prayer, but also in fasting or in some other religious rituals and acts. So if a person is undecided, not sure whether they should fast or not, what should they do? If they fast, would their fast be valid?
Just as there is a hadith which clearly denotes that innamal a'malu binniyat, so every act of worship depends squarely on the niyat that you have. Okay, if you are undecided, it means you have no niyat. You are doing an act, or you are not doing an act. So you are undecided, so you have no intention. So if somebody is undecided in his niyyah, whether to break a fast or not to fast, or fast actually,
yes,
like the fast of Ramadan, or maybe he decides to do so, immediately, maybe after he remains undecided, his fast becomes invalid. Because when you begin to hesitate or decide not to fast, and then again you change your mind to fast, that means your fast has become void and you can never remain undecided. That's why it's very much important that you, as a believer, a practicing person, yes, must begin and form your niyat before the dawn, before actually the Fajr time.
Yes.
And that's the beginning of the time when you are supposed to form your intention.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad. We bid you farewell and keep us in your duas. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Oh Allah, please unite us and guide us to paradise. Oh, and guide us to paradise. Ramadan.
Welcome to Israel Watch. On this episode, we will focus on Netanyahu's threats to attack Rafah and the possibility of military action there regarding the political issues and the captives. This is while the occupation regime has announced the release of two captives in Rafah in a complex military operation. In addition, there are ongoing contacts to conclude an exchange deal, as well as protests and demands to overthrow Netanyahu's administration to hold early elections. Regarding these topics, I welcome the specialist in Israeli Affairs, Professor Ali Haider. Welcome to Israel Watch, dear Professor. So, after the occupation army announced the release of two captives in Rafah during a complex military operation, as they put it, the Zionists began advertising that we can address the issue of the captives without negotiations. But this event will not have a major impact on this issue. The impact of the release of the two captives on the issue of the entire captives have laid the groundwork for those who oppose the captives exchange deal to take advantage of this event and escalate their opposition. Professor Ali Haider, how do you assess the release of the two captives in Rafah in a complex military operation that was prepared for a long time, knowing that the two captives were in the possession of a Palestinian family, not Hamas, according to Osama Hamdan, the former senior representative of Hamas in Lebanon?
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most merciful. In fact, Netanyahu needed such an achievement to justify his positions of refusing to submit to the demands of the Hamas movement in the negotiations in order to continue the genocide. However, the event, in its circumstances and the number of captives, does not change anything from the overall scene. Rather, we can say that it'll be just a passing event. For 2 or 3 days, the world will forget this achievement because 134 captives are still held by the Hamas movement. And therefore, Netanyahu is looking for such tactical events here and there in order to influence public opinion and create for himself a solid foundation to continue the war. This war, in addition to its strategic dimensions, also favors Netanyahu personally. He needs this war to stay in power.
Professor Ali Haider, between the impact of the recent captives release operation and the captives exchange deal, how do you evaluate the Zionist approach regarding the captives?
There, the division still exists at the political level and at the popular level as well, to the point that for the first time in opinion polls, 51% of the Israeli population now supports an exchange deal, even if it comes at the expense of a ceasefire. This is a shift in public opinion that portends what Netanyahu fears. It heralds more transformations because protests are escalating among the families of the captives. All of this is due to the failure to achieve the goals declared so far, not only a failure with regard to eliminating the Hamas movement, which the United States has also begun to say is impossible, but also even at the level of liberating the captives. These could be serious achievements before the eyes of the public, but they have not happened so far.
Here it means that after more than 4 months, Netanyahu has been able to release only two captives, and his attempts have failed on previous occasions.
Yes, the two captives were not held by Hamas. There is news out there, but it needs to be verified. There are talks about a deal with those holding the captives and so on. These things are being said, but I want to emphasize that it is just a passing event whose impact is fleeting and does not change anything in the political scene. The problem is with Netanyahu. No matter how much he tries to find temporary solutions, the effects are not enough to bring stability for his administration.
Indeed, the protest against the way Netanyahu and members of his administration have dealt with the captives at the hands of the resistance in Gaza are escalating day after day. Demands have grown from an exchange deal to overthrowing Netanyahu's administration and holding early elections. Rarely does a session of the Zionist administration pass at the present time without disagreements, divisions, and tensions amongst its members over the management of this aggression against Gaza and the captives exchange deal that is being negotiated. In the last session, there was a rebuke from Netanyahu to ministers in Likud who did not oppose Hamas's terms for the exchange deal. Netanyahu's government is on its way to disintegration. If a deal is concluded for the exchange of the captives with the resistance, Ben-Gvir and Smotrich will withdraw from it. And if it is not concluded, Gantz and Eisenkot will withdraw from it. In both cases, the administration will disintegrate. I mean, according to the Zionist analyst, if the exchange deal is concluded or not, the Netanyahu administration is on the path to disintegration. Opinion polls say that 55% of Israelis want to go to early elections.
In fact, demanding early elections is what Netanyahu fears the most. And everything he does in security and politics is in order to avoid this scenario. But the administration's structure may impose on him what he does not want and what is not in his interest. Here, I would like to refer to the significant point which was mentioned a moment ago. The Israeli captives have become hostages of Israeli policy and the internal disputes within the administration. This is because it is not in Netanyahu's interest to push for this deal, and put it on the negotiating table with his administration members. This will fire up the situation between the two parties. Therefore, we can say that Netanyahu is keen not to appear as someone who is opposed to the deal, but rather wants the opposition to come from the ministers, whether from his party or from outside his party, so that he is not facing the captives' families. This has greatly affected his public standing in this field.
And the occupation's decision to launch an attack on Rafah. The Hebrew media have revealed the plan of the occupation army for the attack, starting with the evacuation of the displaced either to the northern Gaza Strip or to Khan Yunis. The matter is related to negotiations for the captives' exchange deal. The decision to attack Rafah was taken around 2 weeks ago, and the occupation army is waiting for this political decision to be taken and the Egyptians fear large displacement operations to its lands. Mr. Ali Haider, the decision to attack Rafah was taken 2 weeks ago, and the Egyptians do not oppose, but they only fear the displacement problems. What do you think?
Unfortunately, the conditions of some Arab countries have become such that the root of the Israeli attack on the Palestinians is not revealed or exposed, but rather it is reflected on them in a direct sense. And this is unfortunate. This is what dares the Israelis to commit massacres and launch attacks. Regarding this area, however, it is possible to talk about more than one point. The Rafah issue is no longer a field issue par excellence, but it has become an interactive issue that is overlapping and interacting with two other problems, which are the issue of negotiations over the captives and the issue of tensions within the administration. Given that the issue of field pressure through Rafah is the political goal of its timing now, it is linked to the captives' negotiations to pressure Hamas to make a concession. Therefore, the more negotiations falter from the Israeli and even American perspective, the more pressure will be needed through Rafah. It seems that there is an indication of a solution if we might seek some kind of freeze in the field to one degree or another in this area. Therefore, we are facing an issue that has become more complex due to its interactions with other issues. This is in addition to the American position, which has become clear that it is not against the operation, and rather we need a different plan in one sense, and also regarding the Egyptians' concerns. We're facing a multidimensional event intertwined with more than one local and regional aspect.
I mean, it is very complicated. The recent contact between President Biden and the head of the Zionist regime, Netanyahu, regarding the attack on Rafah and the captives' exchange deal, these issues caught the attention of the Israeli media, which have detailed some of what was revealed. Mr. Ali Haider, did Netanyahu obtain Biden's approval regarding the attack on Rafah?
First, there was certainly no serious American opposition. Second, there was perhaps a disagreement about some details and not the origin of the Israeli attack. Third, this position is not denied by the United States, but rather it has become public that we're not against the military operation in Rafah, but rather we need a reliable parallel plan, in a sense, to protect, as they say, the civilians. It has become clear to everyone that protecting civilians means more casualties. This American hypocrisy is therefore a matter of tension. These are provocative expressions with which they want to fool the Arab world and Arab public opinion. Unfortunately, I think more than 30,000 martyrs and more than 60,000 wounded should be enough to expose this hypocrisy. However, we do not actually need these numbers in order to know the truth.
Professor Ali Haider, specialist in Israeli affairs, thank you very much for your participation in this episode of Israel Watch, and thank you for your good follow-up. Take care.
Ooh, 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 ooh.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir Al-Sadr.
He was born in Qadamiya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmud Shahruddin was.
When we say Divan of Hafiz is a book of Irfan,
Maulavi claims that this Masnavi Ma'navi is the interpretation of the Quran.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Very welcome to another episode of the program, The Teacher, an introduction into the religious and scholarly lives of the most outstanding Muslim, Shiite dignitaries, personalities, ulama, and scholars during the history of Islam. I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers, two Islamic scholars from the Islamic House of Qom, Shaykh Rouhani and Shaykh Fadai. Shaykh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And Shaykh Fadai, assalamu alaikum to you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
All right, for today's discussion, we want to talk about one of the Fuqaha of the 13th century Hijra. He is among the students of Shariful Ulama Mazandarani and Sahib Jawahir. He is mainly known as Sayyidul Ulama Mazandarani. His original name was Mulla Muhammad Sayyid Barfurush Mazandarani. So many outstanding details are about his life, his marja'iyya, his struggles against Babiyat and Baha'iyat in Mazandaran province in northern Iran. But before that, Shaykh Rouhani, give us some details about the early life and early education, is better to say, of Sayyidul Ulama Mazandarani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Mullah Muhammad Sa'id Barfurushi Mazandarani was born in 1187 of Hijri Qamari. He was among the great jurists and scholars in the 13th century. And of course, he was among the students of Shariful Ulama Mazandarani, was known as Sa'idul Ulama al-Mazandarani. So in about his, let's say, scholarly life and characters, we can mention this point that Sheikh Al-Ansari, radwanullah ta'ala alayh, knew him as more scholarly figures compared to him. That's why he was known as Sa'idul Ulama.
Yes.
And of course, he was once suggested to take the position of marja'iyya and za'ama of the shayyu. But of course, he rejected that and directed the people towards the Shaykh Al-Ansari radwanullah ta'ala alayh.
Yes.
And of course, he was born in a village called Divkala. Of course, it is part of, it's a village in a province called Babil nowadays,
yes,
which was known as Barfurush in the past.
Yes.
In that time, and of course, he was he died in 1270 in this village and that he was, yes, born. And he was buried in Masjid Jami of that, let's say, city.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, about his scholarly life, we can mention this point that after his education or being educated,
yes,
he came back to his village and of course,
yes,
lived there. This is one of the very important, let's say, characteristics of this great scholar, that he turned back to his, let's say, original kind of city that he was born there,
mm-hmm,
to serve the people. And of course, he missed also the chance of becoming marja because of this,
yes,
coming back to this his village.
Yes.
But serving the people, serving the followers of Ahlul,
yes,
Bayt was more important for him as taking any kind of position.
Yes.
That's why this, the known or the title Sa'idul Ulama is the title that he deserves, that he was really Sa'id, means,
yes,
prosperous and, let's say, happy,
yes,
person. Yes.
That's right. And the position of marja'iyya, or it's better to say religious authority on that time, was so much important. As you said, Shaykh Al-Ansari, after the demise of Sahib Jawahir, was chosen by most of the people. But Shaykh believed that maybe Sayyidul Ulama Mazandarani is more a'lam or is more knowledgeable than him in affairs. So he sent him the letters to Iran. And then Sayyidul Ulama says that, I've been for some years away from teachings and the fatwas. So for you, Shaykh Al-Ansari, it's better to accept it. Shaykh Fadai, so much respect based on knowledge was among these scholars and ulama at that time. This is really an interesting point, isn't it?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As you rightly mentioned,
Sayyid al-Ulama Mazandarani chose not to be a marja. Mm-hmm. And we can say that this was a custom among our scholars. Usually they escaped from these positions. Vice versa, nowadays we can see that people try and struggle in order to get social and political position. They claim that we want to help people, we want to serve people, but usually the ones who struggle in order to get the position, they want to help themselves more than the others. Yes, maybe they help other people, but they are focused on themselves and their future. But yes. Among our scholars, this was a custom not to accept this position, not because they didn't feel responsibility. No. If they felt that they were not someone, there is not someone better than themselves, mm-hmm. they would accept it.
Yes.
Because of that responsibility.
Yes.
But if they felt that there is someone, even one person better than me, that he can bear this burden,
yes.
Usually they never accept it. For
yes.
example, at that time, he believed that Sheikh Al-Ansari is better than himself. And he didn't accept that. Maybe we say so, it is something usual and ordinary because the other one was better. We say that because we are not at that position.
Uh-huh. That's right.
Imagine that someone invites us in order to be in some, I don't know, institute, in some organ,
yes.
organization. And then, after a while, they want to promote us. Do we accept someone else to be promoted instead of us? I don't think so.
Yes.
We say, this is my right.
Yes.
I tried a lot. And
yes.
now the promotion is my right. I have to be promoted.
Okay.
You know, accepting the position of marja'iyya was a great promotion
yes.
for a scholar.
Mm-hmm.
But why they didn't accept that? Because, you know, they know the real religion.
Mm-hmm.
Religion is a knowledge you get from God, and then you have to teach it to other people.
Yes.
Not to gather something for yourself
yes.
by this religion. You know, religion shouldn't be a tool in order to improve your life.
Yes.
For example, Amir al-Mu'mineen, we heard a lot that he has a very poor kind of life.
Yes.
But usually our youth don't know that Amir al-Mu'mineen has a very great income.
Yes.
It was not like Amir al-Mu'mineen didn't have money.
Yes.
He had a lot. Like our scholars.
Yes.
You know, some scholars like Ayatollah Barafurushi, I don't know, Sheikh Ansari, they had a very great access to money
yes.
because of that wujuhat.
Yes, yes.
But usually they lived like poor people.
Okay.
So that is the real science and knowledge
yes.
of religion.
That's right. And another interesting point about, especially about the life account of Sayyidul Ulama Mazandarani, is moving back to his own homeland in order to guide the people religiously, answer their religious questions over there. The sense of commitment that they had to their homeland and the because of the people of the homeland is really fascinating. Thank you very much, Sheikh Fadai.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
Sheikh Rouhani, one of the outstanding points about the life of Sayyidul Ulama Mazandarani was his struggles against Babism or Babiyat on that time. What was it exactly and who were the Babists?
Yes, of course, this part of his life is really significant because Babism or Babiya is a kind of deviation or alteration that is made in Tashayyu, unfortunately.
Yes.
And of course, it is a deviated kind of sect that was born in the history of Tashayyu by the help of colonizers. It was a project that was based on colonialism.
What is it exactly? I mean, what do Babis believe in?
You know, Babism is a kind of belief that there are some people who claim that we are the gate through which you can enter the hidden kind of sphere of life of the Ahlul Bayt, particularly Imam al-Asr. So at the beginning, they were claiming that we are like gate. Bab means gate, door.
Yes, yes. Okay.
By which you can get access to Imam al-Asr. But later, they changed completely this idea. Uh-huh. They claimed that we are the gate by which you can directly access to God.
Uh-huh.
And we are like superior than even the prophets.
Maybe they even claim that we are
prophethood.
Imam al-Asr.
Yeah, of course. Okay. Okay. More than Imam, they claim prophethood finally that was totally a kind of deviated, let's say, sect. So that's why many of these scholars raised against them and actually resisted against them, tried to criticize them. Among them is this Sayyidul Ulama, Ridwanullah Ta'ala Alayhi,
yes,
who actually fought against them, who actually criticized them, challenged them. So his efforts made against this Babism was really significant in the history of the Tashayyu. Actually, he protected the people against the attacks made on the people by this Babist or the followers of this deviated sect in the history of the Tashayyu. That is why it shows that how much important is that when your people, when your nation, when your society is attacked by the false ideas, false ideologies, or false kind of sectarianisms,
yes,
you have this responsibility as the scholar to get back to your own homeland and
yes,
protect your people against these false kind of ideologies.
Yes.
That's why, of course, as you rightly mentioned, it is really a significant part of the scholarly life of this great scholar.
And Sheikh Fadai, the commitment that such ulama had on that time regarding such movements, fake movements inside the religion of Islam, especially the Shiite Islam, is really outstanding. We know that on that time, there was no social network or media working on that time, but such people were really brilliant enough in order to get notice of the false deviations inside Shia Isnashari Islam and then stopping them and completely removing them from the scene of the society, isn't it?
Yes, you know, this kind of action among our ulamas shows us that the theory of secularism is wrong. You know, for example, Babiya, first of all, they claim that this is a kind of religious societies.
Yes.
We are, as my brother mentioned, the gate for Imam Zaman. But after a while, they tried to get the power, having the influence on the society. They want to be in the center of power. And so at that time, our scholars felt the responsibility not just to stop this deviation in our religious knowledge, but to stop this social deviation, political deviation, in order to distort the guidance of religion in our society. As you see nowadays, I just want to mention one of the aspects of Babiya.
Yes.
You can see that their two important cities are Akka and Haifa in Israel.
In Israel, that's
and
right.
They have a very good relationship with them. Yeah. Why is it like that?
Uh-huh.
Do we think about that? If Israel is the enemy for Iranian people,
yes,
and for Shia,
yes,
and Babis, they claim that we are the real Shia.
Mm-hmm.
If they are Shia, what don't they have any problem with Israel and Zionism? And why doesn't Zionism have any problem with them?
Yes.
Why are they focused in those cities? If you just search internet,
yes,
for Babi and Baha'i and see their castles,
uh-huh,
You cannot say building. They have some castles in Haifa and Akka. So, you know, by this relationship, they showed their reality, their hidden reality. And that's why some scholars like Muhammad Said Barfurushi, they try to stop them. They know this future.
That's right.
That they want to destroy the religion, not to have just a deviated sect.
Yes, that's right. Such a broad outlook that such scholars like Sayyidul Ulama Barfurush Mazandarani had. Thank you very much, Shaykh Fadai and Shaykh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration regarding the life account of Sayyid Barfurush Mazandarani, mainly known as Sayyidul Ulama Mazandarani. He passed away in his hometown and village, Divkala, in today's Babol in northern Iran. It was the year 1217. His body was taken into Masjid Jame, or the main masjid or mosque of the city, and he was buried over there. May Allah bless the soul of this outstanding man, and may Allah protect the ulama who are after guiding their people, especially religiously speaking, in different cities all across the world of Islam. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi aman.
Everyone has a beloved, a new dear friend. But I have you, my dear. May God protect you, my dear. May God protect you.
IRIB English Radio, for those who seek the truth.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
As-salamu alayka ya Amin Allah fi ardh.
Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian, appointed by Allah.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. This is To My Brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. It's great to have all of you here, and today we want to talk about a character who not only influenced Muslims across the world, but influenced many non-Muslims as well. This great personality is the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace and blessings upon him. Imam Ali alayhi salam was brought up under the care of the Holy Prophet Muhammad when he was just a small child. And so in this manner, the foundation of the moral and spiritual education of this magnificently intelligent child was based by the Prophet of Islam himself, the greatest educator of all mankind. Imam Ali's mental faculties were to an extent that he believed in the Holy Prophet and his mission at the tender age of 8. Therefore, Imam Ali contrary to the other companions of the Holy Prophet, had never worshipped idols and never partook in the unreasonable demands, the oppressive actions, or the unjust acts of the Arab chieftains. Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we're discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So, dear friends, it is the holy month of Ramadan. What a beautiful month to be able to witness in our lifetimes. And really, it is a grace and a blessing on behalf of the Almighty Allah, the Exalted, the Compassionate, the Merciful. The love of our life, the Almighty Allah, who has given us yet another opportunity and another chance in our lives to be able to witness this holy month of Ramadan. Now, we all know that it is difficult, and of course, when we're being honest, we know it is difficult to fast from the morning until the Maghrib, from before the Fajr prayers, or at least starting at the Fajr prayers. Technically, at Fajr, we're supposed to stop eating. But anyways, we're not talking about the very specific jurisprudential aspects. But from, you know, Suhoor until Iftar, we are fasting. From the morning until the night, we are fasting. This is really very difficult. And nobody is denying that it is difficult. But of course, you know, we also find that there's many countless rewards. And really, to a certain, in certain traditions, we find that the rewards are probably not capable of being calculated. There are so many rewards. And even though, yes, some of us might fast in the holy month of Ramadan, these obligatory fasting that Muslims have to do, unless they have some kind of health conditions. But this obligatory fasting these are the rewards. And what we were saying is that even though we don't necessarily, you know, fast for rewards or fear of punishment, but we fast for the satisfaction and the contentment and, you know, the rizayat, this kind of happiness, if you will, or this contentment of the Almighty Allah. But anyways, talking about Imam Ali alayhi salam, we find that His Eminence was always very cheerful. Sometimes we have this kind of an idea that the Imams were very, I guess, I don't know, ultra serious or very frown face all the time, when in reality they were very beautiful faces. They were very honorable faces. When you would look at their faces, you would feel this sense of joy and happiness and the sense of peace and tranquility, very serene faces, not at all what we sometimes think about them to be. So Imam Ali alayhi salam, he talks about this idea of cheerfulness, and he talks about how it creates love, it creates friendship, and something, you know, as simple as a smile is something that is, leads to cheerfulness, it leads to happiness in the society. You know, even the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him, said that, you know, the simplest and most basic form of charity is a smile. And so Imam Ali alayhi salam here is also talking about smiling and being cheerful. So let's connect the two. In the holy month of Ramadan, if nothing else, why don't we try to smile more often and try to be cheerful and positive a little bit more often in this holy month of Ramadan, and follow one of these very subtle teachings, if you will, of Imam Ali alayhi salam, a very beautiful and profound lesson indeed for us all, brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
At this moment, we invite you to listen to parts of the Arabic text of Ziyarat Aminullah along with its English translations. Please stay tuned.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم فاستجب دعائي واقبل ثنائي واجمع بيني وبين أوليائي بحق محمد.
O Allah, give favorable answer to my prayer. Acknowledge the praise I sign in worship. Let there be peace and harmony between me and my friends for the sake of Muhammad, Ali, Fatima, Al-Hassan, and Al-Hussein. Verily, thou art my benefactor who provides with bounties, the aim of my desires, the ultimate destination of my hopes in my future life and during this short life. Thou art my God, my master and my Lord. Welcome my friends, keep our enemies away from us. To save us from the evil mischief, divert their attention. Let the true world come out in the open, supreme and dominant. Refute and condemn the folly, rendered contemptible. Verily, thou art able to do all things.
إنك على كل شيء
And now we invite you to listen to Fayyaz Ja'far.
I thought to reflect upon one of the most important aspects of the legacy of Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam, and that is of course the letter of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, salamullah alayh, toward his companion Malik al-Ashtar. This particular letter, as we know, has its own unique merit, has been reflected, has been studied, has been researched by a wide variety of different academic bodies. And politicians throughout history have spoken toward the merit of the words of Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, something that probably every single one of us is very aware about. But when it comes deep down into it, it's really important for us to actually read the letter of the Imam alayhi salatu wasalam, because it's far beyond, far more comprehensive than that one line that all of us have memorized, that people are of two types. أَمَّا أَخٌ لَكَ فِي الدِّينِ أَوْ نَذِيرٌ لَكَ فِي الْخَلْقِ, that people are of two types, either your brother in faith or your equal in humanity. The words of Ali ibn Abi Talib within this letter toward Malik al-Ashtar, as narrated by many of the scholars, they state that if someone wants to make a difference in the world, they should take a portion of every single day toward reading a little bit of this letter of the commander of the faithful toward Malik al-Ashtar. And in reality, yes, it is very lengthy. But nonetheless, it's something of the utmost importance in terms of where our mindsets need to be, specifically in light, again, of the socio-political climate that we're living in within this country, within this world, as Muslims and as followers of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salatu wa-salam. So firstly, when you want to try our very best to understand a man like Malik al-Ashtar, it's incredibly important for us to understand the idea of context. The way that the imams, that the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam would speak to their companions, toward their followers, would vary. We know a narration that states, كَلَّمَ النَّاسَ عَلَىٰ قَدَرَ أُقُولِهِمْ. Speak to people according to their own intellects, to the levels of their capacity of thinking. Thus, the way that the Prophet speaks toward Imam Ali alayhi salam is very different than the way that the Prophet would speak to Abu Dharr al-Ghaffari, or the way that the Prophet would speak to Salman, or the way that the Prophet would speak to Bilal. Because the ma'rifah, the knowledge, the understanding, the wisdom of Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen is far different than anyone else. Which is why Salman, for instance, in the narration, he states, and we know that the Prophet would state that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has divided faith into 10 parts, and Salman is on the 10th level of Iman. And even then, Salman, he would narrate that when I would look at the actions of Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, sometimes I would have no idea what he was doing, why he was doing it. So where was Ali in relation to Salman? In reality, there's no comparison. But we see that the way that the Prophet would speak to him is very different again than he would speak to other companions. Why do certain individuals, why are certain individuals recipients of such divine knowledge from Ahlul Bayt while others are not? In reality, it comes down toward their submission toward their Imam. For instance, when we see the relationship of Imam Ali and Kumail ibn Ziyad, if you open up Nahj al-Balagha or if you just Google any, you know, conversation between Imam Ali and Kumail, sometimes you read the conversation and in reality you have absolutely no idea what the Imam was telling Kumail ibn Ziyad. It's way beyond our minds, way beyond our intellects. Why does a personality, for instance, like Abu Hamza al-Thamali, why is he the recipient of the dua of Imam Zain al-Abidin alayhi salam? It's because of their devotion toward their Imam and the unique knowledge and station that they had in relation toward the infallible.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Faced with a general economic, social, and criminal crisis, is Ecuador on its way to overcome them or simply failing in the attempt, and even ending as a failed state?
Or simplemente a fracasar en el intento, e incluso quedar como un estado fallido? Hoy día, el gobierno de Daniel Noboa.
Today, Daniel Noboa's government has undertaken a war against crime,
a la cual acusa de ser terrorista.
He calls criminals of terrorism and cleverly tries to assimilate or present it as the same as the resistance of social movements.
La resistencia de los movimientos sociales. En Ecuador hoy día.
In Ecuador today, a country of almost 18 million inhabitants, we have 5 million inhabitants who live with only $3 a day, and almost 3 million who live on $1.50 a day.
Que viven con un dólar y medio al día.
And 66% of jobs are informal.
6% de los empleos son informales.
That is the reality of Ecuador. In the midst of this war on crime, Noboa has unleashed a number of privatization actions, for example, in electricity, raising the prices for the population.
Y subir incluso las tarifas de la misma la población. Noboa, en esta guerra contra la delincuencia,
Noboa, in this war against crime, has forgiven the debt of large economic groups, and yet he has raised or proposed the raising VAT by 3 points at this moment. That will rise to 15%, which is a lot in a country with a dollarized policy.
La guerra a la delincuencia ha traído...
The war on crime has brought his friends from the leadership of the Southern Command, headed by Laura Richardson, to organize the country.
Para organizar el país. Los norteamericanos hoy día ingresan a Ecuador.
The North Americans are there because today they enter Ecuador without any inspection of their documents or what they bring.
A lo que ellos traen. De cualquier manera, cuando se van.
In any case, when they leave, they're not inspected either. That's the agreement they reached.
Los policías y los soldados que vayan llegando a Ecuador.
The police and soldiers who arrive in Ecuador, according to what they have agreed, will not have to give any account to the Ecuadorian authorities, even if they commit the most